Case number 12-5123, Linda Solomon, appellant versus Thomas J. Vilsack, Secretary of Agriculture. Mr. Carl for the appellant, Mr. Hudak for the appellee.
May it please the court, we're here on an appeal from a grant of summary judgment by the district court. Linda Solomon wanted to continue working just as she'd previously done on a flexible schedule. Solomon liked to work. Her psychiatrist said working was good for her. She even worked on her own time in the evening, so off the clock, in effect paying the agency so that she could work and get her job done. She had serious depression issues, but high performance, and she wanted to work flexible hours, not fewer hours. She had a few bumps in her life. She became more depressed. Her psychiatrist started changing her medications. She was doing satisfactorily through the end of late April 2004. There were no missed deadlines. There was no criticism whatsoever of her work. On April 23rd, 2004, the agency took away her informal accommodations in violation of the Rehabilitation Act. The agency,
you said informal, right?
Informal, yes, Your Honor. And refused to accommodate her in violation of the Rehabilitation Act and alternatively in retaliation for engaging in protected activity. According to the opinion of her psychiatrist, the agency's actions in doing so destroyed her career, thereby rendering the government responsible for the damages that occurred. On appeal, the agency implies in its brief that the people who told Solomon she could no longer work late didn't have the authority to do that, but nevertheless, the following week, the decision was ratified by French and Lawrence, Solomon's first and second level supervisors. The agency never explains why they ended the informal accommodation. There was absolutely no evidence whatsoever of any legitimate business reason for telling Solomon that she couldn't work flexible hours, telling her that she could not work after 6 or 6:30 in the evening.
Did the agency produce anything regarding deadlines and the burden and so on associated with her working as she preferred?
No, Your Honor. There's really no documentation in terms of discussion as to why the agency rescinded the accommodation.
There were some deadlines in this job.
There were.
And so what does the record show about? I mean, maybe it's disputed, maybe not. But what does it show about deadlines and how they were going to be met under this flexible schedule?
Well, looking back to Solomon's experience in the first 4 months of 2004, she met her deadlines working the flexible schedule. There are a couple things to keep in mind when analyzing the deadlines. One is that her deadlines were in part related to the fact that her customers, the people with whom she worked, were at state offices, but they were located in the western time zones, California, Hawaii, Guam. So the later hours actually worked to the agency's benefit. But secondly, looking back at the Solomon's position description, and there's a general reference that she did have deadlines, but that there was not the sort of inexorable deadlines that we see in the Carr case. But more importantly, in the position description, it talks about how the job requires an ability to work independently. And that's what Solomon was able to do. So she did not have the sort of job where she had to be very closely monitored by her supervisor. And in fact, if you look at the position description, the agency put in the record that in fact was an important factor in analyzing what are really Solomon's crucial duties. Now, at the end of May of 2004, Solomon is ready to come back to work. She wanted to come back to work part-time because the drugs were kicking in, and she wanted to go back to her old flexible schedule, but she wanted to ease back in and to work part-time from home. And under the U.S. Air versus Barnett, she made a request that satisfied her part of the deal. She made a request that we submit, number one, as reasonable on its face, and number two, that it's also reasonable under the circumstances, because she was a budget analyst, because of the sort of work that she did, because the people that she was communicating with were in the regional offices outside of Washington, D.C., and her contact with the budget office in downtown D.C. was, in fact, only a secondary part of her job. Now, under U.S. Air versus Barnett, the agency had a duty to engage in a mandatory second-step analysis to analyze the essential duties of her position, to conduct an individualized good-faith exploration as to the sort of accommodations that it was required to provide to Solomon, and to look at the job as it was actually performed. And a lot of the job was performed on the telephone, talking to her customers out in the western part of the United States. And as part of the step two process and set forth in U.S. versus Barrett, the agency had to show that there was no other accommodation that could work. There's no other accommodation that would be effective. The statute says the agency has to consider job restructuring, reallocation of duties, part-time work, or modified work schedules. The agency did not. There was no discussion. There was no dialogue. The law requires meaningful interaction. The law requires good faith. There were none of these things.
MaxiFlex is something, I take it, that federal agencies do use, but the USDA had not previously used. Am I understanding that right, or had they not just used it in her office? Or
They didn't use it in her case for either a discriminatory or retaliatory reason. They, in fact, have a policy described as a reasonable accommodation policy that's in the appendix or on page 1920, and they lay out a special process that the employee has to go through and what the agency has to do and what the agency, what the time deadlines are for the agency. You don't need to keep asking for additional medical information. The focus is on immediate action in response to the request. The agency is supposed to fill out forms describing why the agency did or did not give the requested accommodation. And in Solomon's case, there was a file. Solomon saw a file on the office of the medical director of USDA, and the file disappeared. So there's not the sort of more detailed explanation. But if you look at the email traffic, Solomon said, "I want this accommodation," and you get language from some of the HR people like, I will not approve this employee for a return to part-time work. I will not approve this employee to telecommute without any further explanation as to whether or not there was some sort of legitimate reason.
Did you have ever evidence in the record that other people were allowed to telecommute?
Yes, in fact,
there was longer hours or
other people were allowed to telecommute.
Were they in Booth's unit?
Well, by this point, Booth had left. Booth left in early April 2000.
Well, at the time when people were being allowed to telecommute, were those people working for Booth?
Well, they were all working for Lawrence, who was the next supervisor up. And in terms of allowing people to telecommute, yes, there were other people telecommuting. There were other people working flexible hours because it just seemed to be that kind of job. But there really was no media process. And some of the courts of appeals have talked about the interactive process as similar to a mediation, but there wasn't any dialogue. There wasn't any the sort of give and take that you'd expect in a good faith interactive process.
Carl, if I may, I think your time is better spent on the retaliation issue.
Okay. With respect to the retaliation issue, Your Honor, there are two issues. One is the matter of causation and dealing with the protected activity. We have two arguments there. Number one is that Solomon engaged in protected activity, particularly in the March and April timeframe, March and April 2004. She did so by complaining to Lawrence's supervisor that the pending EEO complaint had not been resolved. Secondly, she filed a formal complaint with the EEO office at Agriculture. Thus, there is a very close temporal proximity, which satisfies the law in this circuit.
She started this process with the EEO counselor back in December, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And experienced no alleged retaliation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then after, when she finally does receive what you see, what you view as retaliation, as I recall, one of your 2 points in the argument was in the brief was, well, that's the first time her supervisor got involved, CC'd on an email or something like that. And that was the occasion for her starting to retaliate 3.5 or 4 months later.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's also...
I have to say that's very weak tea. Is there anything better than that?
Yes, she also filed a formal EEO complaint. And the filing of the formal EEO complaint is also evidence of a protected activity. But the broader point, this may be what Your Honor is looking for, is that under Jones versus Bernanke, under Brady versus the Office of Sergeant-at-Arms, when you review in a summary judgment decision, you look at all the evidence. And what is lacking here is any sort of reasonable explanation for telling a government employee that she cannot work on her own time because this woman cares enough to get her job done.
I understand that argument as an element in the Rehabilitation Act, in the principal claim here. I don't see how it carries over causally into the retaliation.
Well, it carries over insofar as a reasonable jury might find, why did they take, or in asking the question, why did they take away the informal accommodation that had been given to Solomon
on April 23rd?
On April 23rd.
That was done, was it not, by a temp who was filling in?
Well, and that's where the government's changed their position, Your Honor, because the decision was ratified the following week by both French and Lawrence. And so even if somebody was ostensibly or arguably acting outside of their authority, a reasonable jury could find that, number one, that wasn't true, that explanation, and there's really no strong evidentiary support for it in the record. But number two, what really caused the worsening of Ms. Solomon's condition, and else is all laid out in the timeline and the materials under seal, but what really disturbed Ms. Solomon most of all is the fact that French and Lawrence ratified the decision saying that there's no way that she could work after 6 p.m. And
it's tracing that back to the EEO activity that I have your facts, I got it. Yeah. Tracing it back that strains credulity.
Well, in terms of the temporal connection, we're looking at the short period of time between Solomon's appeal over Lawrence's head to Lawrence's supervisor.
Right, so after doing nothing for 3.5 months, even though there's a CEO allegation against her, when her supervisor is CC'd on an email, she becomes retaliatory, is the story, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I guess under Singletary, looking at the letters and filing of the formal complaint, we believe that would be a protected activity. There's also the argument that by virtue of acting or by requesting an accommodation, that's also a protected activity. The judge, even though as far as we can tell, every circuit in the country that has addressed that issue has held that asking for an accommodation is protected activity under the Rehabilitation Act. District Court did not think that argument was at all meritorious, and if this court were to affirm him, that would create a split in the circuits on that. On that particular
You're back
issue.
On the main claim now.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, I have.
And also with respect to the question of, for example, looking at what the EEOC guidelines do, the other courts of appeal have lined up with the EEOC guidelines on that particular point.
Am I correct in thinking that since the agency, as I understand it and as you agree, put in no evidence about timeline, deadlines that she would be unable to meet even with accommodation, that in itself should be sufficient to require a remand without regard to getting into any of this interactive process stuff, right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
So, that, I mean, if you're right on that, isn't that the shortest distance between here and your client?
I hate to have to come back a third time, Your Honor. And I would ask the court address the absence of the failure of the agency to engage in the interactive process.
If at the end of the day you have a claim valid enough to go to a jury, what's the difference whether there wasn't an interactive? How can that be an independent violation of the act?
Our argument is that it's not an independent. Some circuits of courts have held that it is independent.
It's like you don't want to take yes for an answer here, Mr. Carr.
No, we're not arguing that as our fundamental point, because the agency made no showing whatsoever to carry its burden of proof that there was any burden associated with Solomon working the flexible schedule.
All right, and all the stuff about the lack of an interactive process, all the facts will come in. It's just not a separate, doesn't need to be a separate legal claim.
I can understand why the court would rule
that way. All those facts would come in your case showing that the government hasn't made its, and didn't even attempt to make its case based on deadlines.
Yes, but part of it would certainly help the Solomon's position if she were able to argue that, in fact, there is a ruling from the Court of Appeals that the agency is required to do these things to engage in good faith in the interactive process, and the agency did not, in fact, do so.
Right.
I've exhausted my time. Are there any other
questions? Thank you.
Questions?
We'll give you a minute of response, Mr. Hudak.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Brian Hudak from the U.S. Attorney's Office on behalf of the Secretary of Agriculture. USDA asked this Court affirm because the District Court correctly granted summary judgment on Ms. Solomon's claims under the Rehabilitation Act and on her retaliation claim. First, as to the reasonable accommodation claim, there's no genuine issue of material fact that on and after April 23, 2004, Ms. Solomon became unable to work.
Unable to work because you all wouldn't let her work a flexible schedule.
Well, Your Honor,
as a question of disputed fact.
Your Honor, it's not, I don't believe that is salient to this point. The undisputed facts.
Why wouldn't it be salient whether your failure to, your withdrawal of, and I'm just stating disputed facts here, I'm not saying it would actually happen for purposes of summary judgment, that if you all had withdrawn a flexible schedule she previously had and met all the deadlines under that flexible schedule, it's at least a disputed question of fact whether she could have kept doing the job after April 23rd with the same or similar schedule.
Well, Your Honor, but there's no genuine issue of material fact that the agency who was aware, the individuals at the agency who were aware of her accommodation request and her disability took any action on her, with her on April 23rd. Ms. Solomon's own statement on April 26th, so just 3 days later, noted, it got worse on Friday, April 23, 2004. I had a very emotional day. As a courtesy, I informed my acting supervisor, Norma Torres, who is my peer coworker, that I'd be working late to complete assignments due on Wednesday, April 28. Peer coworker with no knowledge. There's nothing in the record to indicate that Ms. Torres, her peer, had knowledge of an accommodation request that Ms. Solomon viewed as highly sensitive. Went, talked to HR, learned the duty hours, and said, these are your duty hours. You have to work these. And that is the situation that led to her becoming unable to work. Again, on April 26th, before any alleged ratification of that decision, Ms. Solomon was already saying that the only option for her was disability retirement on Joint Appendix 1362.
Well, because she thought the option of telecommuting was off the table. It had been denied.
The telecommuting didn't even come up until the end of May, Your Honor. The issue that was still pending at that point in time was a request for a flexible time schedule.
That's right. That's right.
That was made at the end of March.
And she thought that was not on, right?
Your Honor, I don't believe that there is any reasonable inference from the record that existed. She made the request in March.
She was told she couldn't work after 6 o'clock like she'd been able to all the months before.
Your Honor, the record reveals that on March 29th, she made the request for an accommodation to her first-line supervisor, Ms. Booth. Ms. Booth was directed not to share that information with the ultimate decision maker.
Well, this is all sort of factual stuff that they say, you say. I mean, with the district court, just to get to the heart of it, the district court here didn't go off on this ground that you're going. The district court said that as a matter of law, it's unreasonable to ask for an accommodation for a MaxiFlex or the type of flexible schedule that she was asking for. Do you defend that judgment, that aspect of the judgment, or not? It's unreasonable as a matter of law to ask for a flexible schedule like she was asking for.
Yes, Your Honor, we do defend it, but the district court did parse between these two things. And so
let's just tell me how you defend that, given that MaxiFlex is something recognized by OPM. She'd been doing it for about 4 months. How is that unreasonable as a matter of law?
MaxiFlex is not recognized by OPM. There is nothing in the records to suggest it is. The Carr case is the case that is directly on point, in which this court said that even though the employee had received outstanding ratings, similar to Ms. Solomon in that respect, she could not predictably maintain an 8-hour day and sought an open-ended schedule.
But in that case, did she not have strict 4 p.m. deadlines that had to be met every day?
There were strict deadlines.
What strict deadlines does the record show in this case that had to be met every day so that she could not work the way she worked for the previous 4 months?
Your Honor, there isn't with that precision in the record, but Ms. Solomon agreed that there are short deadlines and precise timeframes. That's a quote from her deposition.
She certainly didn't agree that they were short deadlines and precise timeframes that she couldn't meet on a flexible schedule. Isn't that the question that we need to answer to sustain a district court ruling as a matter of law that this is an unreasonable accommodation request? I want to stay focused on how the district court ruled.
Well, again, Your Honor, you have to place it in the context of the claim. She has to first establish that she's a qualified individual with a disability, meaning she can work with or without a reasonable accommodation. And after April 23 of 2004, there is no dispute in the record that she cannot work with an accommodation.
I'm sorry, after April 23, there's no dispute? There's too many negatives for me.
I'm sorry. It is undisputed that as of April 23, 2004, she was unable to work. The government lists on pages 35.
Right, but the cause for that, I think, is Judge Ginsburg was referencing, was because she'd been told she wouldn't be able to have a flexible schedule.
But not by the people that were part of the decision-making process, the interactive process that she began and that the agency promptly engaged in. On April 22nd.
Did they correct it? Did the HR people, when they realized someone had been told flatly they couldn't do it, did they correct it and say we can do a flexible schedule?
No. What happened was that early that next week, she wrote to the agency saying, I am unable to work. I'm going to be out on leave for an indeterminate amount of time. She then, in an email exchange after her April 26, 2004 statement, talked with Mr. French. Mr. French said, well, I need medical information to support this leave. And the decision about 6 p.m., my stance is that unless I have approved work that needs to be completed beyond your normal duty hours, your work day will end no later than 6 p.m. That's entirely consistent with Solomon's testimony as to what her accommodation, her informal arrangement was with Ms. Booth, is that when the work demanded to work past 6 p.m., she was allowed to. And that is exactly what Mr. French is saying. Unless I have approved work that needs to be completed beyond your normal duty hours, your work day will end no later than 6 p.m. Again, that informal arrangement was made with unconnected to any accommodation process. And what Ms. Solomon was doing through the accommodation process was to formalize an arrangement that she could work on into perpetuity, not on an ad hoc basis as the work demanded. She wanted the ability to work whenever she was able to. And that is what her condition required of her, unfortunately, given the severity of her mental health condition, that she wasn't able to predict her time frame. And so that schedule, the court in Carr said, was unreasonable. And other circuits have said that predictable attendance, coming to work on a predictable schedule, is an essential element of any job.
Of every job?
The First Circuit has said that, yes, Your Honor, at page...
You don't have to give me the second.
A generalization like that is not going to matter one way or the other.
But Your Honor, the situations, the cases that Solomon cites in support of her position that a MaxiFlex arrangement is permissible isn't the type of completely open-ended schedule that she is requesting here. It's not a work-when-able-to schedule. The MaxiFlex schedules that have been recognized in Breen and the other cases cited by Mr. Carl in his brief do not concern where it's completely unpredictable. So on a day-to-day basis, the agency is unaware of whether she's coming to work, for how long she's coming to work, or anything of that like. Again, the reasonable accommodation process was begun at the end of March. The agency promptly responded saying, we need medical documentation to understand your limitations, to understand what your condition is, so that we can craft a reasonable accommodation for you into perpetuity. This isn't going to be an ad hoc basis, an informal arrangement with your supervisor. This is going to be a formal accommodation that you are entitled to as a matter of law. And so we need medical documentation to understand what your limitations are. And as of April 23rd, when she had this unfortunate interaction with her peer, not her supervisor that was part of the accommodation process, that request remained pending. And at that point in time is when she became unable to work. The agency never denied her reasonable accommodation that she requested in March of 2004.
With respect to retaliation, do you know what date you received the formal complaint she filed with the EEO? Same day or another day?
I do not believe that's in the record, Your Honor.
Okay.
She claims she filed it on April 12, 2004. Mm-hmm. Again, that is after the agency sent its letter kicking off the interactive process regarding her end of March accommodation, and falls temporally, it's not temporally proximate to really any denial decision that she complains of.
Well, it's certainly temporally proximate to April 23rd, April 12th.
Well, she doesn't allege, and there's nothing in the record to support any reasonable inference that the peer employees engaged in this activity had any idea that she had any protected activity whatsoever. And so, Your Honor, there's no reasonable inference that there was any retaliation based upon prior protected activity that these employees were engaging in. There's just nothing in the record to suggest that the agency denied an accommodation. The accommodation process was underway at the end of April when she became indisputably unable to work. Your Honor, so unless there's any other questions, I see my time is up.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Does Mr. Carl have any time?
1 minute.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the April 23rd exchange, now the decision was made by a peer co-worker. This the first time that arguments was raised was on appeal. There's an implication, certainly, that this person was acting without authority, but when you look at the evidence in a light most favorable to Ms. Solomon, it appears that a reasonable jury could find that, A, they had the authority, and, B, in any event, to go back to Judge Millett's question, did they correct it? No, they didn't. In fact, they ratified it and the decision to limit Solomon's hours and plus take away her de facto informal accommodation. There's certainly, judging from the argument this morning in the briefs, they're standing by that decision. With respect to how much Ms. Lawrence knew, Ms. Lawrence was a supervisor throughout the entire relevant time period. The district court's statement about Lawrence leaving is not based on the record. But the point about Lawrence is that even though Ms. Solomon didn't want her...
He didn't leave, but there was someone standing in for him on the 23rd.
Beg pardon?
There was someone standing in for Lawrence on the 23rd.
Yeah, well, it was just, somebody to whom the authority had been delegated. But they seemed to be implying in the briefs that this person was acting without authority. At least that was what I understood their arguments to be, both in their brief and today. But Ms. Lawrence, in any event, was there throughout. She was the key decision maker, and she was certainly actively involved. And this is one page from the appendix I want to draw to the court's attention. And when you're thinking in terms of drawing inferences in favor of Solomon, whose case was summary judged out, it's the appendix on page 1752. And this is... You've probably seen the memo from Solomon a couple of times. It's her March 2nd memo. And on March 5th, the memo gets passed on to Arlene Christian, who's one of the HR people. And the memo begins, Deborah asked me to share this email from Linda since it deals with medical issues. Deborah is Deborah Lawrence, and at the very least, the jury could find that Deborah Lawrence knew, if not having read the entire Solomon March 2nd memo, was certainly fully aware of its contents. And secondly, there were conversations between Ms. Solomon's psychiatrist and Ms. Lawrence with a view to explaining to Ms. Lawrence exactly what the what Ms. Solomon's problems were. And what we don't dispute is that Ms. Solomon was depressed, but that's a very different analysis and inquiry from whether or not, with a reasonable accommodation, she could do her job. And certainly her track record during the first 4 months of 2004, but there's not a single word of criticism of her performance or missing any deadlines, supports the fact that she certainly was very highly qualified, and there's no indication whatsoever that she had any problem meeting any of her deadlines or that the flexible schedule that she had been working on and was trying to continue in any way negatively impacted the work of the agency where she was employed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.